Kia rana, this is Tangatoa Te Moana from RNZ Pacific. I'm Don Wiseman. This week, violence has erupted again in Bougainville. The benefits of marine reserve areas are bigger than we may have thought. A call for a rethink on autism. Rough waters for a PNG gold refining scheme. The Americans are growing their own kava. And Pacifica rugby greats take the spotlight. The general manager of a radio station on Bougainville says a significant number of businesses in Bouin, in the south of the main island, remained shut after a week of violence last week. Factions from Kono constituency clashed in the town in the autonomous Papua New Guinea province, burning down many shops, including the local studio and transmitter of New Dawn FM. Its general manager, Aloysius Lakau, told me more about what happened.
Not really the radio station, but it was a problem for the community. And there was a killing in my area. They attacked our people living in Bouin town. So I was one of the targets with other people from Kono. Kono constituency is the biggest constituency in Bougainville. And we still have infighting in there. What happened was it happened in Bouin town, and police could not stop what was happening. They could not prevent the burning of properties in Bouin.
The radio station was just one of a whole series of places that were wrecked, destroyed.
Yes. Businesses from my area are still closed. They are waiting for, they did a petition to the government, and I haven't seen the petition. But I talked to the police, local police, because there were some youths that were involved. And the police officer in Bouin, John Popi, told me that the stores won't be opened until the government comes back and replies to the petition. There was a big meeting in Bouin.
Yeah.
Despite the meeting stopping the youths destroyed our properties. That's the only service, radio service in South Bougainville. And yeah. Once they destroyed it, that's nothing.
Your other transmitters can't reach through there?
No, until we rebuilt, now they have nothing. We established in 2017, so that's about 8 years. We've been providing the services, but there's no other service like that in South Bougainville.
You were down there at the time?
No, we have personnel on the ground who switch on. They make sure they control the situation. But I live in Buka.
Yes.
And we broadcast every day from, we are on satellite from Buka to Arawa and Bouin.
So they can listen to you off the satellite?
Yeah. If they have satellite receiver, they can get us. But the transmitter used to, you know, relay the Buka station to part of Solomon Islands too, because we are on the border with Solomon Islands.
You talk about Kono constituency being the biggest in the region. What are people fighting over exactly?
It's a fighting between a group. They call the, it's a part of the crisis, and that didn't stop. We've got gunmen fighting each other, and it's just been going on. I tried my best to talk to UN, talk to the government to find a way to stop the conflict, but nothing has happened. Resulting in its escalation that has resulted on burning of our equipment in Bouin, South Bougainville.
We had been told that there were different factions from within the Mikimui.
Yeah, that's one and two.
So you think they'd be on the same side?
No, they are on different sides.
What are they fighting for?
To me, I don't think they have any good reason for fighting, but it's just payback killings that's not stopping. In 2011, we had a peace agreement signed between the Mikimui one and the fighters, and they started again. They stopped for a while in 2011, and they started again. And after the 2019 referendum vote, some people were attacked, and they moved, left their places, and they are just staying in case sentence in South Bougainville since 2019.
Is that related? Are these people who were opposed to the referendum?
Yeah. These people who were fighting, they were opposed to the referendum. That's why they chased all the people who voted in that area for during the referendum. So they left their homes in 2019, and they are still out there in care centers in Bouin.
And so how many people in care centers?
Could be about 100, between 100 and 200.
And who's providing for them?
Nobody's helping them. They planted food, and they are living on land only. But their survival is it's limited. They don't have any way to get money, but they're still there. Some aid organizations like Red Cross has been giving them some food for some time, but now they are on their own.
So let's go back to the radio station. When do you think you'll get back on the air in Buin?
The cost of the damage is about 1.5 million. So what we are doing now is the situation is still tense. Once the situation is okay, we'll go assess the damage, clean up the place, and maybe do a fundraiser to rebuild for South Bougainville.
An extensive study on marine protected areas has found they're economically beneficial to both fishing and tourism. The report examined close to 50 protected areas in 25 countries around the globe in a range of habitats. Study comes as Palau looks to reduce the size of its marine sanctuary in a bid to improve commercial fisheries revenue. Caleb Fotheringham has more.
Lead author Professor Mark Costello says marine protected areas, or MPAs, are simple, cheap to manage and effective at protecting stock.
You constantly hear this refrain that, well, marine reserves push fishermen away, fisheries lose out, and there's even economic models which also assume that fisheries lose income or lose catch due to the marine reserves. And yet I couldn't find any examples of this.
He likens MPAs and fisheries to someone putting money in the bank and living off the interest.
Fishermen don't have this opportunity to take care of their best fish, and marine reserves are in a way providing that refuge for their stocks to help stabilise the population and the progeny of those fish and lobsters and other animals spill over to the fishery right beside it.
But in Palau, the country's president, Surungal Whips Jr., says the nation needs the money from commercial fishing.
We basically lost $3 million a year out of our national budget. These are fisheries licenses and economic activities and taxes that we collect off of this that were going into funding schools, hospitals. That had gone away, it had gone to zero.
President Whips says at least 30% of the nation's exclusive economic zone will remain protected, but all of its waters will be actively managed. He says the decision 5 years ago to ban commercial fishing from 80% of the nation's waters was an arbitrary decision with no logic. Mr. Whips says jet set conservation groups who don't know what life is like in Palau offered their opinion on what should be done. He says they have more interest in awards than well-managed oceans.
To come into Palau and say, we want you to maintain 80% because you need to be the leader, and we'll give you an award for that. Well, I'm sorry, that award never paid for a single textbook, it never paid for a teacher's salary, it never paid for a nurse. That's the reality we have to face on the ground. So it's wonderful to say all these things, but in the reality, is you also have to take care of the people.
Independent policy expert Dr. Hugh Govan says Western scientists are fixated on MPAs.
The situation in developing countries is very different from developed countries. Often there's little money, there are many burning societal objectives, livelihoods are based on natural resources, the ocean, some a lot of its subsistence. There's not necessarily large amounts of tourism, and governments are struggling to provide services for their population, and natural resource management does not receive very much support.
Mr. Govan says marine protected areas are economically beneficial, but are not always the best or most cost-effective tool.
Fortunately, the Pacific has come up with its more appropriate approaches to management based on actually their traditional strengths. And those include the knowledge and traditional stewardship of the ocean.
Mr. Govan says the Nauru Agreement, which controls the world's largest tuna per seine fishery, is an example of a sustainable management approach that is not a marine protected area.
Pacific communities are being urged to rethink autism and find new translations without the negative connotations. Events are taking place across the globe for Autism Awareness Month, including here in New Zealand. Samoan husband and wife duo with an autistic son are leading autistic support events in Wellington as part of their support group called Pages. Autism is a spectrum and lifelong neurodevelopmental condition that affects how autistic people perceive the world, think and behave, and communicate and interact with others. Daniel Villamoni says Pacifica is a vehicle for change when it comes to autism awareness.
autism month is every month for us, literally day by day. When we started off in the journey, when our son was diagnosed post-COVID, we were looking for spaces that were quite personable to us, you know, around being more Pacific. And my wife already done her research, and she connected us through to a passage group that was already established and started here in Wellington. It's been a blessing being a father to an autistic child, my son. And the reason being is because being a minister's son, raised up the traditional way through the Methodist Church, I was actually quite fixed in my mindset around, you know, how to do things culturally as well. So what my son has done is sort of opened my mindset and my heart into just different ways of looking at things. I used to be the guy, you know, oh, that naughty kid. You know, I used to be black and white, but now I'm quite colourful. You know, I'm always like, oh, you know, there's something happening here that we don't understand. And I never would have had that mindset if my son was a diagnosed. So I'm actually grateful. With our journey, it's not a 9-to-5 or a 9-to-3, it's a 24/7. And the more we're open about that and, you know, in a traditional Samoan family, the more we've been able to encourage other Pacific families or just any family that you have to find the recipe for you. Being Samoan, first and foremost, the term for autism is not a term I would like to use or that the Samoans like to use, you know, in terms of their language. You know, translating what autism is in the Samoan language is not a positive language or word. And that's only because there still needs to be work done around what that looks like in the Samoan community. I'll give you an example. So takiwātanga, that's a beautiful word, you know, used in Te Reo A. And we tend to use that a lot in our spaces. Yes, it's not Pacific, and that's okay. But, you know, it is Te Reo Māori, and they've captured the essence and beauty of what being an autistic person or being an advocate for an autistic person, people's family. That's where I want to head to for Pacific, finding a word that captures in a positive light. So if we're thinking about changing Pacific terminology for autism, that's a massive, massive work plan or work program. And you know what? If people are listening to this, I challenge those organizations to get that started, and I'll be more than happy to assist and provide, you know, my 5 senses and as a proud autistic father, and got my wife as well. And then, you know, we'll be able to connect communities, bring them together, bring families together, and then just talk and speak about autism and what that is for people. And obviously everything's done through, you know, the families, the Pacific families, the churches, the communities, and how do we get them on the journey? So it's about not leaving anyone behind when that kōrero, when that talanoa starts. But before we even get to that, we need to identify which are the agencies, which are the groups that we need on that table first and foremost. So, yeah, it's massive, eh?
And when you go back home to Samoa and you've just come back from a trip, how do you go about creating awareness within Pacific Islands when you do visit?
I think for us it's about being proud, first and foremost, you know, of the journey. You know, we don't shy away from what this looks like for our family, so we're quite open. Because we've just arrived back from the islands, you know, Air New Zealand were great around, you know, their awareness of this disability. They had a green card for us, and it said invisible disability, and they identified to their workers that, you know, my son was on the spectrum. And what that did was allow my son to be him. And what that also did was build the awareness around the people that were traveling that, you know, my son's on the spectrum. Not that he was getting any special treatment, but he was just getting a different treatment. You know, he's got sensory needs to sound, sensory needs to light and all that stuff. So, you know, I was really proud of how those different agencies or those experiences impacted our journey to Samoa with our family. And then, you know, getting to Samoa, because we haven't got a word to identify or a positive word that we like in the Samoan language, we just continue to use autism and autistic. And then we explain in the Samoan language what that is for us, because it's different. It's different. The spectrum is broad. It's massive. To me, that's the richness of what capability looks like, of what capacity looks like. And was it from a cultural lens? Because the talanoa around being an autistic person or what autism is in the Samoan language, it's beautiful. So we, you know, we talk about, you know, connectedness, talk about collaboration in the Samoan language, and it takes it away from what the actual meaning is in Samoa. He doesn't have autism. He is autistic. And the more we get used to that language, the more our people understand. And the way that we explain it to our Samoan families is that, you know, I would never say that you have Samoan. You are Samoan. It's the same for our son. He is autistic and he is Samoan. So, you know, it's things like that. And I think once they understood that, they, like, you know, it was like a light bulb moment. And for me, that was like, oh, man, maybe we need to be in the islands a bit more. Started at the grassroots and then make our way over to New Zealand and see what we can do. But, man, if agencies or if providers, if community groups are wanting to connect and come together to work together around what autism is or what the spectrum is, tell you what, my wife and I will be there. Support in whatever capacity. And the beauty of that is that it's already got that collaboration.
For the past several years, the Papua New Guinea government's been talking about adding value to the country's gold production by establishing a refinery. It's revealed little about the plans, but there's legislation now before Parliament that would authorise a Singaporean-Australian business to set up and manage the refinery in Mint and retain the majority interest. There's been a lot of criticism of the plan from communities and from the Chamber of Resources and Energy, which says it risks undermining a key part of the country's otherwise fragile economy. And the executive director at the PNG Institute of National Affairs, Paul Barker, is furious about the scheme, something he says he's seen many times before. The government has this National Gold Corporation Bill. What's it trying to achieve with it?
That's a very good question. Its stated aims are to try and achieve greater value added for PNG out of the gold sector, feeling that the gold all departs the country and that we're not getting accumulating foreign exchange reserves and the benefits to the extent that PNG might be able to gain if it was doing some both processing and then ostensibly storing it and building up a PNG gold reserve. That seems to be the general gist of what they have in mind.
This company that they're working with, Refinery Holdings from Singapore, they are to build a refinery. Is that right?
That's ostensibly the case. Not just the refinery, the agreement, which is a very substantial document with 50, 60 pages of small print. It allows them to basically run an army, import weapons, and control a mint.
Run an army? Seriously?
Yeah, they can bring in and run a sort of like a military security operation, and they can ad hoc import weapons to service it, presumably all to protect the gold reserves that they're going to have and the mint, which they seem to think is going to be bigger than the Canadian, or at least as big as the Canadian and the Western Australian mint.
There are a large number of gold producers in the country, and if operations such as the Panguna mine get back off the ground, there'll be a whole lot more. And they're not going to be happy with this, are they?
No, because it basically gives the control over the whole processing and exporting of gold to this one monopoly. And they may choose not to export because they may decide that they want to retain it and to mint gold coins. I think, you know, some people think that we should be going back to the gold standard or something. But no, they're going to be very unhappy. And you don't actually make a lot of money out of the refining of gold. But if you have a monopoly and you're controlling the gold trade, yeah, you can make a lot of money out of that. And that seems to be what they have in line. But in the agreement, and the company involved seems to sort of be involved or claims to be involved with lending money to governments or securing funds for governments that are unable to meet requirements from international financial institutions to be able to borrow money and secure money for these other purposes. It's all very reminiscent of the 1990s when oil started being produced in PNG, when we had all the spivs and con men arriving in PNG. We had some rather exotic. There was a supposed Ethiopian princess who wanted to take over the Lihir mine. We had all these others who were promising hundreds of millions and sometimes hundreds of billions of funds from Saudi royal family sources, from all kinds of other bizarre sources. And yet, in the 1990s, we used to check, when I was working in government, we used to check a load of these companies out. We'd check out. They would claim to be in the top floor of an office building in the Gold Coast and they weren't there. Or they would be in a building in Hong Kong and we would have someone visit it from the Hong Kong police. And we would then discover, no, they're not there. But the next day they were there. That would be a new office that would suddenly be set up in that premises. So these are the sort of guys who in the 1990s did their best to cream off the resource wealth or the apparent resource wealth in PNG. They roam around the Pacific. You sometimes have some of them appearing when they don't make it in PNG. You'll see them in the Solomon Islands. You'll see them in Tonga and various places. Of course, Tonga had the court jester who cleaned out their country's revenue. But you see them hovering around. And it takes a lot of money and effort to go and examine each of these different schemes or scams. You would think that by now, nearly 40 years after independence, PNG would be in a better place to actually screen these, to provide wise advice from the Treasury and Central Bank to caution against this sort of thing.
So we've got this company from Singapore.
Singapore with some Australian principals. Yeah, there's an entity from Australia. I think there's an entity that's based out of Melbourne. But
well, we can't necessarily call them shysters, can we? At this point, anyway, they are a legitimate company with a legitimate plan, and if they're taking in the government,
they have a 200,000 capitalization and they're wanting to be handling billions, so one would really be a little concerned. And then if you look at the document and the free rein this entity is being given over PNG's resources, that is extraordinary. And it really is, as I say, it's reminiscent of the 1990s characters that we used to have knocking on the door on a constant basis. And as I say, it cost a lot of money to go and check these entities out. And many of them were just these paper entities or entities that had no... I remember one of them that was then telling me, oh, look, if you want to check out my credentials, ring up Tommy Soeharto in Indonesia. I said, oh, sure, I'll do that. I'll pull back here. Is that Tommy? Yeah, I'd like to check out whether this company is a really bona fide company. We had dozens of these things, and the exercise was basically barring the door to them. This one looks very similar in many respects, although they certainly have some lawyers up their sleeve to write out very long and detailed project agreements.
All right. So an organization like the Institute of National Affairs would be hoping that this doesn't get any further along the line.
Absolutely. It really damages PNG's credibility. It will certainly frighten off major investors in the resources sector, which are already pretty scared by law and order issues and uncertainty over a range of policies and so on. We already closed the Porgera mine for some years, which at the time when gold prices were really at a peak, and we lost out nearly 3 and a bit years of production and revenue and foreign exchange out of that process. You know, we've got a very uncertain resource situation with the potential Papua LNG at the moment. We don't know quite where that one's going. And really, the government would do well to try and take a step back and focus on what government's priorities are or what they should be dealing with PNG's atrocious health situation. We have some of the worst health indicators in the world. I think it's the worst immunization rates, the third worst access to health services, according to WHO and so on. Education system, which is pretty basic. And if they could focus on that and having standard, consistent, sound taxation arrangements, rather than trying to take over all the functions of the private sector, which government is no good at, then PNG might actually start getting revenue, create some investment stability, and go places. Whereas at the moment, everyone's really throwing their hands and saying, where is PNG going?
Recent reports of carver being commercially grown in the United States have sparked concern about the threat this poses to the Pacific Islands carver export industry. Whenau Whanua has more.
Welcome to Cup of Kava in Clarksville, a unique destination for those seeking a relaxed cafe experience.
That's the advert of a kava bar hidden away in the small city of Clarksville in America's whiskey state of Tennessee. It's one of at least 6 kava bars in the states. Estimates on the number of kava bars in the U.S. vary from 180 to over 1,000. and that number is growing. Less than 2 weeks ago, Massachusetts welcomed its first kava bar, Root Awakening.
You can actually go out, have fun, get a different feeling. It's not drunk or high, we get rooted.
The owner, Penny Kimmett, told CBS News he was already planning to open a second bar in the States. For the Pacific Islands, the growth of kava bars in the U.S. means more exports and more money. Fiji's Ministry of Trade reported in 2021 that kava exports had more than tripled since 2016. Last year, Vanuatu exported 351 tons of kava to the United States. Californian entrepreneur Tyler Thomas says the demand for kava is rapidly growing.
We're the largest kava drinking culture. We've got over 10 million kava drinkers, 400 kava bars. Probably in the next 4 or 5 years, we'll have a few thousand.
Thomas is a stakeholder in Kavafied, a U.S. company that grows kava in the marsh areas of Florida. Thomas says the domestic production of kava in the U.S. is still in its pilot stage, and there's no agenda to displace the kava industry from the Pacific Islands.
We have no intention of attempting to cut the islands out from kava. That is not the goal of this exercise. The global kava market is growing, and so we're going to approach a point where if Europe opens up, we're not going to be able to keep up with demand.
But word of kava being grown in the U.S. is raising concerns in the Pacific. Kava is the main source of revenue for thousands of farmers across Fiji, Vanuatu, and Tonga. Last week, Fiji's Prime Minister Sitiveni Rabuka told the Fiji Times that there are no market protections and that Pacific Island kava producers needed to lift their game. Fijian kava exporter Praveen Narayan says there's concern.
I think whatever they are planting is on a pilot stage. My concern may be after 5 or 10 years if it is really, really successful. But what the Honorable Prime Minister has stated, I think he rightly stated that the exporters, even the farmers, everybody need to up their game.
Kava researcher Apo Aporosa of Waikato University says there's an urgent need for Pacific Island governments to support their kava farmers.
It's going to affect exports and it's also going to affect GDP. There is a no win for Pacific people out of this. Our leaders have to speak up.
Aporosa has accused kava entrepreneurs in the US of cultural exploitation.
These people, these Americans, are going into the Pacific. They are using their very flash language. This is what we would expect from the culture industry, okay? It's just diversionary spin aimed at hiding biopiracy.
In 2020, kava accounted for 49% of Vanuatu's exports and 28% of exports from Tonga.
It was a night to remember. The first ever Pacifica Rugby Hall of Fame induction attracted a full house to Eden Park just before Easter as the Pacifica rugby community turned up in numbers to honour their legends. Former rugby players and their families were on hand as the legends paid tribute to those who had helped them along the way. Ilyasa Tora was also at the event.
Well, it'd be great. George Smith, who has Tongan linkage, says he was honoured to represent Pacifica players like the famous Willie O, or Viliame Ofahengawe, Daniel Manu, Ippolito Fenukitau, and Totai Kefu, who paved the way for him and other Pacific players down under.
Yeah, look, it's great that there's a recognition of Pacifica players with Hall of Fame for rugby. It's great that the community comes together and celebrates their athletes, I guess, not just from New Zealand, but from all around the world. So I can see this definitely going in different pathways with academia and so on, but it's nice to see this evening be recognised.
The late John Lomu's wife, Nadine, was on hand to receive her husband's award and said the big man would have been honoured to be recognised by his peers.
It's an extreme privilege for us to be here representing Jonah. Like anything, there's nothing more that I would have wanted than for him to be here to take this honour himself. But to be able to take the privilege for him, he's truly deserving of it, just like all the other inductees. And so it really is a privilege to be here and to be part of the movement for our Pacifica people and the greater good of what it really is.
Sevens Wizard, Fijian Waisale Serevi, who played in 7 different Rugby World Cup competitions, paid tribute to all who assisted him in his career, especially those he had played against.
Thank you to all the coaches that I played with. Without those coaches, I wouldn't be here. And all the players that I played with, without all of those players, I wouldn't be here too. And the most importantly, all the players that are here, that I played against, that have been chasing me all around, that made me the rugby player I was all the time.
There were also parting words from Nadine Lomu, who encouraged Pacifica players and people to continue the late John Lomu's legacy to stand up for who they are, both on and off the rugby field.
Follow the dreams of what you believe in. And really, no matter what the adversities and the trials and the tribulations of what we are faced as Pacifica people, no matter the discrimination, no matter how we are treated or how our voices become dampened, because we are who we are. The biggest thing for me is really reminding our Pacifica people that we can be all that we want to be.
The night also honoured four current Pacifica players who are continuing the Pacifica rugby legacy in Adi Savea, Mark Telea and Ruby Tui of New Zealand and Samoa, plus French rugby rep Manae Feleu, who hails from Wallis and Futuna.
And that is Tangata Otemuana from RNZ Pacific. Thanks for joining us. I'm Don Wiseman. Until next time, tofa.